Welcome to the
Humanist Union of Madison. And our speaker today is Andrew Kerr, speaker of the Free Congregation of Sauk County. And his topic is secular humanism. Is it a religion? That'll only take the first 20 minutes or so, and then we'll open it up for discussion. I know there's a lot of topics that you're interested in. So welcome, Andrew.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you all very much. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. What I have here is a copy of a talk that I gave at the Free Congregation, I think in the fall, I'm not quite sure when. And the title is Secular Humanism, Is It a Religion? That's as a question mark. And of course, I'm delighted to speak with all of you about today's topic because I get to share my favorite Mark Twain quote. And it reads, it ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And Al Gore uses that to good effect, of course, in his famous movie or documentary. And what I want to say to you today is secular humanism is the application of Mark Twain's quote to religion. Now, you might say it doesn't really matter very much to try and get clear about terms like religion or secular humanist. At an organization like this one, everyone is welcome here, so we can maybe leave those to our personal choices, definitions about those terms. Well, Timothy Harris, he wrote a book entitled The End of Faith. I don't know how many of you have had a chance to read that book. Yeah, it's a very important book.
Sam Harris.
Sam Harris, you're right. Yeah, not Timothy Harris, it's Sam Harris. Oh, that's right, my mistake. And as far as I could tell, an argument of that book is that religion permits and even encourages human violence. And religion permits and encourages human violence, Harris argues, because religion refers to all of those claims about the meaning of life that you know for sure that just ain't so. Religion demands that we understand the meaning of life in an irrational way. That seems to be Sam Harris's point. And so religion generally allows violent solutions to conflicts about the meaning of life. Religion doesn't tolerate rational resolution of discussion and debate about things. So it always comes down to violence. Now, I find Harris's book very seductive. You can read the book and agree with it. And as I felt myself doing, and yet afterwards, there you are, maybe there I was wanting something spiritual in your life and wanting at least to explore religion. And so you have two emotions. There's the emotion religion is bad, and then there's the emotion I want to explore religion somehow nevertheless. And so what you have, or what I had when I read the book, is kind of an emotional mess. The two feelings dim one another. And I didn't feel in my heart any sense of direction or any pull, any attraction. Maybe some of you felt the same way when you read the book. But I find with books like that, and I said this before in my last talk here, about a half hour ago or whatever, that everything rests on the definitions. Harris makes cogent arguments based on bad definitions. That's my opinion of his book. And bad definitions confuse our feelings. That's one way you can feel a bad definition. Bad definitions of religion, bad definitions of secular, they confuse our feelings about what makes life meaningful for us. And so I think we need to find better definitions. That's a place to start. So we can feel our religious feelings to the fullest if we feel that we have any. Now, to begin, there is the idea that secular humanism is the rejection of religion. I've heard that said. And several friends of mine have put the point quite clearly. Actually, my wife has put this point quite clearly. Religion is B-U-L-L-S-H. I can continue, yeah. Now, this is an articulate idea. And if that's how you want to use the term secular humanism, absolutely do so, because you have an articulate, clear meaning. The problem is, at least in my opinion, is that this meaning is rarely the meaning that's used by writers and thinkers that everyone seems to recognize anyway as secular humanists. So I thought we could take a look at Albert Camus, whom nobody would recognize, I think, as a traditionally religious person. It was Camus' belief that there is no meaning out there that people can find in the world. So in a book of his entitled The Stranger, that's one translation of it. I don't think that's always the best translation. Camus, in effect, runs an experiment. What would life feel like if we gave up on meaning? If we gave up on meaning and just let the, quote, benign indifference of the world roll over us. I think that's the thought experiment that's going on in Camus' The Stranger. And the answer is that life feels very disturbing and ends in violence. If you're familiar with the story, the main character kills somebody, commits a murder. Without meaning, it seems, there is no reason to care any more about what happens. And that's the attitude that the main character in The Stranger adopts. He's just unable to care about much of anything. And that, I think, is the fundamental question. I think that's the fundamental question for any human being, for any one of us. The fundamental question is, why should I care? Why should I care about anything? Why should I care about anyone? Granted goodness, so what? Why should I be good? I was asked that question in one of my classes at the Divinity School. Okay, there's goodness, but why should I be good? So what? And this fundamental question frames the fundamental choices that we have. The fundamental choice is, yes, life can be meaningful, and so yes, there is a reason to be good. There is an answer to the question, why be good? Or no, there isn't any meaning. Meaning is impossible. We should abandon that whole project. And the thing is, every secular humanist philosopher I've ever encountered, and that's just the ones that I've encountered, concludes that we must make a choice for meaning. I rarely read any writers that conclude that meaning is impossible. That's not to say there aren't some. Chekhov's plays, I think, have some of that. Absurdist literature, there's some of that. To be human, we must feel meaning in our lives. And that's something a lot of secular humanist thinkers will say. Camus' The Stranger is not a rejection of meaning. That book is not, I think, a rejection of meaning. That's not what Camus was doing. But it is a rejection. It is a rejection of the claim that meaning is found in the world. But The Stranger also points, then, to the new idea. The new idea, it's a very 20th century kind of idea, at least for the West, for our civilization, points to the new idea that meaning is something that human beings can make for themselves. And we don't have to look to God or to the world or to the cosmos for meaning. We have to make it ourselves. Now, the most famous proponent of this position that I know of was Jean-Paul Sartre. Jean-Paul Sartre took to the extreme Nietzsche's proclamation. He read a lot of Nietzsche, took Nietzsche very seriously. Nietzsche's proclamation that God is dead. That is the starting point for almost all of Sartre's philosophy. Because God is dead, there is no God in the world. There's no God in the world out there to give our lives any meaning. So we have to assert that meaning for ourselves, together as human beings. We are so free, Sartre argues, that we must even choose the very meaning of our lives. We don't just choose how we practice that meaning. We even have to choose the meaning itself of our lives. We are, as Sartre puts it very beautifully, we are condemned to be free. We must make our own meaning. So perhaps secular humanism is distinguished from religion because secular humanists deny God as a path to meaning. That would be one way of distinguishing these terms. Sartre's philosophy encourages this way of so distinguishing. In my opinion, this distinction doesn't work. Our founding fathers believed in God. There's a lot of contemporary research going on about their religious beliefs or their spiritual beliefs, and that's the general conclusion of the scholarship as far as I know. But our founding fathers believed in a God that left her creation to its own devices. They were deists, and for deists, meaning is still a human project. God creates the clock, the mechanism of nature, and then walks away from it. And it's up to us to figure out what to do inside of it. So meaning is still a human project for deists who nevertheless believe in God. Now also I know a few people who believe in God, but they believe that God is evil, that God is bad, that God is a mischief maker, a troublemaker, who causes a lot of problems in the world. And so humans have to struggle to make meaning in the face of a God who is an enemy. There is also the theory that God is so strange as to be incapable of providing us with any sense of meaning. I recommend looking at Samuel Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot, as a good demonstration of that perspective. So anyway, my point is simply that you can believe in God, okay, you can, and still feel in your heart that you and other people must create meaning without help from the world, help from God, help from anyone. The idea that you have to, that we have to create our own meaning, I think, is independent of one's beliefs about God. So what does secular humanism mean then? You can be a secular humanist and still believe in meaning, just like a religious person. You can be a secular humanist and still believe in God, perhaps. So I sometimes feel like I'm the kid who just tore up all the Lego sets. I'm sort of tearing up all the old definitions, maybe. So what am I going to build? What new definitions can I build with all the pieces here that I've got assembled? Now, there was a dialogue that I read at the congregation. I won't be able to read it here. And it was from Camus' The Plague. And it's a good, this dialogue is a good place to start rebuilding. In the story, in the dialogue, when pushed as to whether the question of God separates the main character of the plague from the town's priest, in the story, that's another story by Camus, The Plague, and it's when a plague takes over a town and begins to kill off most of the inhabitants. Rue, who's the town doctor, what he says to the priest, he says about the town priest, well, he hasn't come in contact with death. That's why he can speak with such assurance about the truth. But every country priest who visits his parishioners and has heard a man grasping or gasping for breath on his deathbed thinks as I do. He'll try to relieve human suffering before pointing out its excellence. Now, this dialogue teaches, I think, that the question of God is not the basic religious choice, the basic religious question. The basic religious choice, the basic religious question, is whether we feel that meaning is something we create for ourselves, or whether meaning is in some sense given to us by the world in some manner. Now, Camus and his country doctor character, or city doctor character, Rue, they favor the first option. We create meaning by fighting against suffering. There's a lot of Buddhist elements in Camus, I think. Now, the town priest, by contrast, who's of course Catholic, argues that the meaning of human suffering is how it reveals God's will. Okay, that's a very Catholic perspective. Now, that's the old Jewish understanding, the old Catholic understanding. It's the Abrahamic religion understanding. But what Judaism, in my opinion, what Judaism and many of the other axial age religions, Buddhism is, I exclude Buddhism from this point, what they never saw clearly was that the question of meaning is always a struggle. It's always a struggle. It is a process. It is a story. Whether we create that meaning for ourselves or whether in the end we find it, it's always still a struggle. So secular humanism is not, in my opinion, the refutation of religion, but it is the refutation of revealed religion, of the idea that religious truth is completely just given to us, handed us on a plate, as it were, in some extraordinary moment in history. Okay? The story of the plague, by contrast, is the story of people struggling with meaning, to make meaning out of all the death that they see around them. There is no revelation in the plague at all, only moments of suffering, moments of relief, and the struggle to find meaning in the relief and in the suffering, and in the way our lives pass through one and the other continuously, without end. It never changes. Now, a second thing that you can learn from reading The Plague, I think, in Camus, the secular humanist, is that the question of meaning, the struggle to create it, perhaps, or to find it, that it's a human work. It's a human work done through conversation and done in community with others. After all, Camus presents the question of meaning in dialogue fashion. The characters discuss, they argue, and they reach their own distinct conclusions. That's often what happens in The Plague, is people are arguing about questions of meaning, about religion, about whether God exists. There is no authoritative answer. Christianity, Judaism, Islam, the religions of the West, they all completely miss this religious insight. the idea of a special, extraordinary moment of complete religious truth has encouraged, I believe, the habit of crushing religious questioning with the fist of authority. That idea of revealed religion, I think, encourages a tremendous amount of authority in religion. If everything is revealed, there's nothing to talk about, there's nothing to argue about, all of our questions have been answered. It's just a question of whether you're with us or against us. And often these axial age religions present religion in that manner. Buddhism is an important exception. Now, secular humanism teaches that life is far too crazy, far too absurd, far too painful ever to think that we have the complete truth. We must keep exploring, always exploring religiously. So here are my definitions for secularity and for humanism, which I borrow from these two religious insights that I see expressed in Camus' The Plague, but in other secular humanist writings. Secularism is the idea that religion is exploratory. It's a question that we ask and we discuss. It's a process of constant discussion, constant debate, and constant rediscovering. It's a science. It's another one of the arts and sciences, and it's an everlasting process of journeying and discovering. There is no complete finished truth that's been handed to us on a platter by God. That's what secularism means to me. So it is like science in that way. Secularism is the claim that religion needs to be a lot more like science, a lot more open-minded the way science is. And so we need publicly to stay neutral, of course, about the various proposed religious answers, because that's what allows that debate to continue. But what we should do publicly is support the debate instead. I think it's very important for all of us as Americans to talk more publicly about religion, because that's the scientific way of discovering the truth. As you talk, you discuss, and you put your deepest personal feelings on the table and let other people criticize them. That's very, very important. Scientists are able to do that. We can all do that too. We can do that about even our most deeply held beliefs. Now, humanism, I believe, is the idea that people have to do work to acquire meaning in life. It's up to us to find meaning. God isn't going to hand us meaning on the silver platter. The stars are not going to give us meaning on a silver platter. And frankly, the land will not provide meaning for us on a silver platter either. It is our job to do the work of listening and engaging and creating that meaning, perhaps, if that's what we think, or finding that meaning, as Sartre and Camus suggest, or creating that meaning, as Sartre and Camus suggest, or finding it in the world somehow, engaging in the journey of engaging the world and finding that meaning in the world. And I think Buddhism does that to some extent. I think Hinduism does that to some extent. I think secular humanism is the most important set of religious insights since the Axial Age religions themselves. Karen Armstrong has come to that conclusion as well. Secular humanism has clarified, in my opinion, what the real task of religion is. It's about finding meaning. It's not about God. It's about finding meaning. And it also has clarified what the pitfalls of religion are. The pitfalls are authority and passivity, not using our reason to explore religious questions, listening to authority instead. So is secular humanism a religion then? It is a religious path. It is a way of being religious. It is the way of being religious that is the gift of the Enlightenment tradition, in my opinion. And I do think that there is a secular humanist religion, in my opinion, and that's Buddhism. Buddhism is the first secular humanist religion. The Western tradition has not developed a secular humanist religion, but I think the Eastern tradition has. Now, what there isn't yet is a secular humanist religion that is theistic. That has not arisen yet. What you heard from me today is an attempt to develop a form of theistic secular humanism. That's terotheism, secular humanist theism. It's an attempt to do that. So we'll see how that goes. A religion is the job of finding meaning in all events. That's the job of religion. That's the question that religion asks. Therefore, religion in particular takes the job of finding meaning in suffering. That's the key thing, right? Because that's where meaning gets hard to find and where meaning gets hard to believe in. Religion is about recovery and cultivating an emotion that I call joy. And joy is that sense that things are meaningful, even when they're painful. Viktor Frankl talks about this in his book, Man's Search for Meaning. He asks the question, how did people survive the concentration camps? And he says that the ones that survived the concentration camps were those who found meaning in the suffering that they experienced there. They were able to endure those concentration camps with the sense that there was some meaning in that suffering. Those were the ones that survived. And I think secular humanism is a way of recognizing that searching for that joy, searching for that meaning, is always, always going to be a struggle. So anyway, thank you very much.
I have a question.
Yeah, sure.
A basic question.
Sure.
I don't quite understand what we are looking for in a search for meaning.
Right.
I'm not sure that I do search for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
How
mm-hmm.
would you define what you're hunting for?
Yeah, the question is, what do I mean by the search for meaning? What I mean by the search for meaning is the sense that our lives contribute to something.
To one another's lives.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a legitimate answer to that question.
So is that basically saying what we're here for?
Yes. What are we here for?
I think I'm here to be just like the blades of grass.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I'll meet somebody someday.
Mm-hmm. And that's an answer. Other people share that answer too.
But that's not a struggle.
It may not be a struggle for you, and if it's not a struggle for you, I think that's fine. It's certainly been a struggle for me, and I see the blades of grass too, and I share your perspective to some extent. What happens to me is when I look closely at the blades of grass, I see a lot of suffering going on in those blades of grass. A lot of insects are being killed. I'm sure. Oh no, I know you are.
But that's part of what living is.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think it is too.
We're all interdependent in many, many ways.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I find that to be something that I've had to struggle with. I've had to struggle to find the meaning in that kind of suffering. I don't mean to claim that everybody has, but I'm just somebody that has had to do that. And
I think the meaning is that everything, living, dying, suffering, being happy, is all part of the whole cycle. It's mm-hmm. just the natural way that things are.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. No, I agree. I agree with that perspective too. I agree with that perspective too. But what always strikes me is I want to know that the suffering makes a contribution too, that it matters. Because when I've suffered in my life, that's something that I've struggled with. Is what's the value, what's the worth of the suffering that I'm undergoing right now? And when I read about other examples of suffering, like the victims of the concentration camps, that was the agony that hurt them the most. Is what is the meaning of the suffering? I'm in this concentration camp. I will probably not survive. My family is dead. There is no rescue for me. They didn't know that the Allies eventually would come. They thought that was...
I bet their meaning, though, was to help one another.
Often they weren't able to help one another. The Germans wouldn't allow it. That's what they report, anyway.
I don't
anyway.
Mean by ways the Germans yeah. would know, by being supportive of one another.
To the extent that they could, but that was very difficult for them to do. That was part of the agony, was the loneliness, I think, mm-hmm. of the concentration camps. But I only say that as someone who has read accounts. I've never endured that kind of suffering, so I don't speak with authority about it. But it just resembles my own sense of suffering that I often ask, what is the meaning of it for me? Because you're right, it's a part of the system.
Yeah. Mary had a question.
Yep.
Well, more of a comment. I've been a secular humanist for probably most of my 87 years, and I don't feel that I'm suffering. I feel that what I do is what matters, not looking for meaning or struggling. I don't suffer, but I don't feel that I've struggled to find meaning. I just mm-hmm. find my meaning in being, as it says, being part of the world,
mm-hmm.
and especially part of the human chain of being. Mm-hmm. And I agree from what we've read about the Frankl and others, that the ones who, whether they survived or not, their meaning was helping one another, even if it was just holding someone's hand or being there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Amanda was next.
Yeah, sure.
This is not what I was originally going to say, but I kind of want to comment on that. Their meaning, you know, aside from what they were able to do in that time, has carried forward into the future.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we say this will never happen again, and, you know, it lives on in that way. So the meaning of that is so much broader than, you know, what they might have ever been able to understand from their perspective. My original question was, I heard you use the word religion a lot, but not the word spirituality, and I think maybe some of what you're talking about in terms of the individual struggle would fall better under the title of spirituality, because a lot of people, when they use the word religion, mean, you know, religion, the church, the dogma, the institution, and to not separate out the individual yearning and desire, which I call spirituality, from that kind of, I think, confuses the whole conversation, so...
I use the words interchangeably.
And I think that might...
Right. Yeah. I use the words interchangeably because I'd like to decouple the word religion from the institutionalization of it. That's all.
Good luck.
Good luck. Yeah, no, that's very difficult to do. I think that's very difficult to do. Because religion is... spirituality, I think, has that sense of it being an individual enterprise. And it is an individual enterprise, but it's also a communal enterprise as well. And I think the key is to make spirituality or religion something communal without institutionalizing it to the point that we have the problems of authority and passivity that have haunted religion, I think, since the beginning. You know, it's hard. I mean, I think generally human beings, our efforts to create organizations were always haunted by authority and passivity. Where we're dealing with an aspect, I think, of our biological nature that we're still trying to learn how to deal with. Yeah, so. Yes?
Language is what we're dealing with here. And every term, every word has meaning. Mm-hmm. Science is something we're dealing with. If I look out and look at the sky and say the sun is shining, but the clouds seem to be moving from the south very rapidly, to me that means it's probably going to be warmer this afternoon. So meaning is attaching predictability or some kind of understanding, at least, about something. And I'm a little troubled by terminology and language here. To not believe in a supreme being, as the word atheist ascribed to it. Mm-hmm. Well, I can describe myself as an atheist, but so often people say, oh, that means you must have rejected God. Well, I'm no more a believer in God than I am a member of the Kiwanis. To me, it's something you decide to do to become a theist, in my mind, if you choose in that direction to think that there is a supreme being. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious as to where the line comes in language and in our understanding and our meaning, in which meaning and religion, in your terminology, become the same.
Oh, sure. Yeah, the question is why do I use religion and meaning as having the same, basically the same thing?
Right.
Yeah.
So if you ascribe meaning to anything, that therefore means you must be religious.
That's right. No, that's right. Yeah. I would say that humans are always being religious, no matter what else they're always being, because humans are always the question, are always the beings that experience the meaning of what they're doing. And so the word religion is being controlled by the term meaning. And the term meaning refers to the way in which things contribute to others. And religion is the question which asks, what is meaning? What is the definition of meaning? How does meaning work? What gives meaning in our lives?
Okay, and so if you feel that you're ethical, that means you must be religious.
You do have to be religious, I think, to be ethical. But it's very important, this is where the meaning of terms is so important.
What does religion mean?
Religion, in this sense, has the same meaning that ethical has. It has the sense of asking the question, to what do my actions contribute? And that's also what we mean by good. When we assign the phrase goodness, or the term goodness, to action, I would say, generally speaking, what we're doing is we're asking, what is the contribution that my actions make? That's the meaning of our actions, and that's also the goodness of our actions. And so I think ethics and religion are very, very intimately connected with one another. The difference between the two is that religion is a much more restricted enterprise than ethics, because religion just asks the question, what do we feel makes our life meaningful? Ethics has the further practical question of asking, how do we take whatever we feel is meaningful in our lives, and of course that's different for all of us, as it should be, how do we take what's meaningful in our lives and make that practical in our lives, make sure that it is always informing our actions, whatever it is that we're doing? And that's a particularly ethical question that is not, I think, religious, but strictly moral. So I do think that ethics and religion are different. Ethics is the most more logically inclusive term, and religion is a subset of ethics. Yeah, go ahead.
I've been wondering about the relationship of meaning to kind of self-worth.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what do they say in French? Raison d'être. I can't pronounce it.
Reason for being.
Reason for being.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Many individuals that tend to be sociopaths feel totally worthless.
Yeah, they do.
And it's, as we all know, it's very, very important for us to feel worthy and contributing positively to our particular society, I guess, we're involved in.
Contributing to something. There are people that live all alone by themselves in islands off the coast of Alaska. I don't know if they see anybody. But they still have to feel like they're contributing to something, I think.
Maybe we sharpen our minds to understand what's going on. To think about these cults, these little cults where people are faithful to the person who is sort of leading the cult. They live in this little isolated world, thinking that anything they do to help out the people who are sort of leading the cult. And of course, that leads to horrible things like everybody committing suicide just because it's part of the cult.
Yeah.
It's got other elements in it too, though.
Self-destructive.
Yeah, cults are not religion. Cults are cults.
Yeah.
This was one of the most important messages, frankly, that perhaps Jesus meant to give. All we have are records of what he said that date at least 50 years after his death.
These individuals that are committed to this cult.
Yeah.
Think that they're doing the right thing.
They're also very fearful, though.
Don't
you think so? They're also very fearful.
They're very fearful, yeah.
A sense of
and belonging.
Well, yeah, no, those are, I'll speak about that a little bit. Another way of putting religion, and this is clear in the Buddhist and the Hindu tradition, that the task of religion is to make us fearless. Because when we're fearless, we have that sense of meaning. We feel it. And we can put that sense of meaning before others and take the criticism that comes when we do that. And that makes us fearless. And so we don't join cults anymore because we feel certain in our journey, in our religious journey. Jesus' ministry was a rejection of ritualistic, cultish religion. He saw Judaism, I believe, heading in that direction. And his correction was to remind that tradition that religion in the end was something that was about meaning, something about how you feel about your life, not about doing particular ritualistic acts or about doing what somebody tells you to do. And that's what cults are all about. Cults are all about ritualistic acts and doing what you're told. They are the antithesis of religion.
They use the same vocabulary as religion.
They do.
God and chosen and prophet and revelation. And so,
right.
I mean, that's kind of, I think, maybe what you were getting at. What I was getting at is, everybody says religion and, means maybe this much of it or this much of it or, and it gets to be quite confusing.
Right. Well, I think one of the tragedies is that some of those religious concepts like God, like ritual, in our effort to rightly eliminate that cultish authoritarianism that the West has struggled with so much in religion, as we start to throw away sort of the baby with the bathwater a little bit. There are many other ways of thinking about God besides the way that the Christian religion would have us think about it. As rational beings, we are required by our reason to consider those alternatives. That is what it means to be open-minded. To be open-minded is to consider all the options. Christianity is one option. There are many, many other ways to think about God. Look at Hinduism, for example. There are many other ways to think about God or goddess. Our reason requires us to do that. An atheist has a very difficult job. An atheist, to be confident in their opinion, has to be able to reject every putative idea of God that the human species could ever propose. It's a very difficult thing to do. It's a lot to ask. Yes.
And my definition of atheism, atheism, it's being without God. I mean, that's not part of your consideration in the world. And also, we are all, as human beings, we are storytellers. And one of the stories we've made up is the story of whatever God is. God, it's a story. And in my view, it has no relevance to our lives.
Right, I think that's your view. It's a view that puts, you know, many other people have a different view. They don't think God is a story. Our reason, I think, as rational beings, we are required to debate and discuss those differences, I think, rather than simply accept them in ourselves and keep them private. We need to put them on the table and have them debated, discussed, criticized, no matter how hurtful that may sometimes be to our deeply cherished beliefs. And that goes for theists as well as atheists. And now the point about atheism and the unimportance of believing in God, well, that's my wife's position. My wife doesn't deny the existence of God. She just doesn't see what the point is.
I agree with your wife.
And that's how she... But this is why I think that the beliefs in God are... That's not really the fundamental religious issue anyway, is whether you believe in God or not. The fundamental religious issue is what makes meaning in your life. Maybe God does that for some of you, maybe
that's
not.
That's the task of every person who is a thinking person.
Yes, I think it is.
Or
they
connect with the concept. And people that never connect with concept aren't going to worry about it.
Right. So if you know, God doesn't work for my wife, and so she's not interested in it. And I think that is a wonderful conclusion to come to, because that's what works for her.
I'm not sure that I agree that our task is to constantly massage these beliefs. I think our task is to act. And keep our beliefs to ourselves and act in public. I don't think it's important to argue with you about your belief or argue with anybody else.
Right. But I think what happens sometimes is, of course...
I'm trying to understand it.
Yeah. But we never keep our beliefs private when we act in public, because our actions are an expression of our beliefs. So as soon as we act in our beliefs in public, we've made our beliefs public too.
But no, that's not necessarily true, because we can act together with many people whose beliefs we don't share at all. We don't even have to talk about it.
I think you're right, up to a point. And that's why I think that God can be a very unimportant religious topic, because the fact is that... But I think a struggle that we have as people who want to see life in a rational way, whose fundamental commitment is to reason, is to adopt a perspective that the Enlightenment has always done, that a belief in God is something that we should dispose of as we dispose of these old authoritative religions. I still believe that it's a live topic that should be discussed. Most people still believe in God. They do. And it's something that deserves a lot more rational attention.
I have a story. When we lived in Iowa, you know, that's the Bible Belt.
Yeah.
And we were on our way to a meeting in Ames, and we picked up a couple who lived out in the country, Gilbert, outside of Ames. And so they were telling us, we had our little girl with us. She was about 4 or 5. And they were telling us about their daughter, who was a missionary, and on and on about all that. And then they asked the common question, the first question in Iowa that people ask when you meet them is, and what church do you go to?
Yes, yes, right.
And our little girl pipes up with, oh, we don't go to church. Dead silence.
Yep.
Forever and ever. But the idea of many of these people was that you, if you didn't go to church, if you didn't believe what they believed, you were not a moral person.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that so offensive,
mm-hmm.
Because I consider that we are very moral, ethical mm-hmm. people. And we express those things in the activities that we engaged in while we lived in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And that people had to see were ethical and moral. But that particular couple probably never would be convinced.
No, I think that's a very painful experience, and I share your feelings about that. I've had the same thing happen to me, and I think that points out the real limitations of that old-fashioned view of doing religion. It's very judgmental. It's very exclusive.
If they said you were Catholics or Jews, they might have been equally worried about you.
Yes.
They were probably fundamentalist Protestants.
Well, we just never had an occasion to discuss it. It was not a discussable issue. I mean, we were dead as far as they were.
Well, you're giving them a ride, though.
They got where they were going.
Yeah.
That was just one conversation.
You mentioned the term teratheism. Where does that term come from?
I made it up. It's my own term. Tera means earth, and theism means God.
You realize if you don't see it spelled, you might think it's terror.
I know.
Yeah, I have a feeling it was a syllable like terror.
Yeah, that's a good point. I appreciate those comments. Maybe I need to come up with a different term. That's definitely possible.
It was the love of the earth, and I'm fine with that.
Yeah, yeah. That certainly is a big part of it.
Terophilic.
Yeah.
Terophilia.
Yeah.
Yeah, terophilia. Yeah, maybe that's a better term. Yeah,
and that one. That's more accurate.
Well, that one has the niceness that there's no theism in it too, which can be very important too. I think
we need a better word to include the sun.
Yeah, that includes the sun.
Sounds pretty darn important.
Universal.
Amen.
Amen.
I have another comment I'd like to make.
Sure.
Many people think that there's got to be a God because this is all so awesome and so amazing that it could not have happened mm-hmm. by any other means, physical laws or whatever. But then they make up this concept of God in their heads and they share it through history that is patterned on a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And where's the logic in that? If the human being is what they pattern it after, why not simply allow the physical laws to be the creator?
Yeah, well, I don't know that there is any logic to it. I think that really depends on the particular kinds of arguments. But I think the fundamental question is: do you feel the presence of God as you walk through your life or not? And some of us don't, and some
Can
of us and some of
word?
Us do. Yeah.
Do you feel a sense of awe?
I do feel
that
a sense of awe.
That works for me instead of the word God.
Yeah, yeah, and that where I feel a sense of awe, and I feel a sense of God.
Yeah,
probably. How do you distinguish the two?
And appreciation.
Yeah, how do I distinguish the two? I feel a sense of awe. I feel a sense of wonder. I feel a sense of appreciation. I feel a sense of awe and appreciation at the things which are not God, but I also feel. I feel it, anyways. When I walk in the land, I'm on my farm, and I just feel this. This is just about me. I feel that the land is haunted by this presence of this creature that. In some way, doesn't send tornadoes. I don't think God has the power to make one piece of rain drop from the sky. I think God, in some respects, is the most powerless creature in the universe. It has no power. We have more power to make it rain than God does, in my opinion.
So how is your concept different from simply having awe?
Oh, because I sense the presence of a personality
of
something
else.
Personality.
Personifies it.
I do. That's just how I feel. So I speak out of those feelings. But those feelings are only important religiously if you feel them. If you don't feel them, I don't think religion needs God. Religion is a perfectly viable enterprise without God.
Well, I think I feel a sense of.
If you don't want those feelings, you better not come down with temporal epilepsy.
What's that? I'm sorry, I just missed what you said. I'm sorry.
If you don't want to have those feelings that you described, even if you don't believe in prayer, you should pray not to come down with temporal epilepsy.
Okay.
I think my sense of awe is as much a person to me as your sense of, not a person, but a presence. Because no matter where I go in the world, I see such beautiful stuff.
Yeah, me too.
Everywhere I go, in every size, tiny, tiny, and huge.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's a remarkable place.
It's just, for me, it includes this haunt. It's like that. All that beauty is also haunted by this presence. Woodworth talks about that. If you read any of his poetry, of course, he walked around a lot in the nature. That's what he did, and he always felt this haunting presence. Tintern Alley is a good poem for that. Not everybody feels it, or they feel it and they conceive of it in different ways.
I think that's all.
No, they define it differently, and I think that's completely legitimate.
Who was raised with this concept of God, even if they later turn against the formalized church, they will still perhaps describe that feeling as God. They have a happy childhood. If they were raised in a secular family, they won't.
That's possible, for sure. Yeah.
We take our context from history, and certainly someone in the Middle Ages didn't conceive. They conceived of God as a very poor symbol, more or less benign. Creature that ruled their world. Not always benign.
No, I'm not sure it was always benign either, but yeah, right. I think there's a lot of not benign, but I take your point, yes.
When you attended Chicago Divinity School, was it with the idea of perhaps becoming a minister?
No, my goal was to become a professor, mostly of philosophy, in a particular philosophical theology, and mostly to do research on the relationship between particular forms of theology and physics and evolutionary biology. That was the stuff that was interesting to me.
Forms of philosophy and physics together.
Yeah, and theology. And theology. Yeah. Newton, physics and theology have often had a very close relationship. Isaac Newton believed in God and makes several references to God in his Principia Mathematica and his famous work on physics. Now that tradition's been dropped with the rise of a more enlightenment way of thinking about things, but I think there can be a place to recover some of it. But you have to think about God in a much different way than Isaac Newton was thinking about God to pull it off.
He was in a state of survival too.
No, Isaac Newton.
Yeah.
I
mean, with church attitudes and.
He was. Yeah. I think he was. Yeah. But then I fell in love with farming, so I decided I would rather experience these things rather than just talk about them. You know?
Yeah. A thinking farmer is a philosopher.
That's the tradition that I enjoy the most in the United States, is the tradition of the philosopher farmer, and in the sense that the philosophy arises from the experience as a farmer. Yeah.
You've got lots of time to think if you're sitting in
class. I do. I get more time to think than I did if I were a professor, actually. I don't have to go to any faculty
lucky
meetings.
To escape that
I task. Did. I do feel lucky at this point. I don't regret it at all, but I did. Not at all. So. Yes?
I'd like to bring up what I think is a closer related topic, much bigger, and that is how we as humanists, as we're all humanists, can best deal with our human ecological crisis, world ecological crisis that we're experiencing. And most of us here are pretty familiar with
mm-hmm.
the fact that we're on track to the world in general is on track to having maybe 10 billion people. And with the idea of much of the world to have a yearning at least to have a standard of living like the United States, which would require perhaps 5 Earths or something like this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen those. I've seen those studies. They're very upsetting.
And so, and people that Leopold said, who we talked about needing land ethic. Is that enough?
Yeah, he talked about, you know, he was an interesting guy. He does talk about the land ethic, but there's a lot of spirituality, I think, in Leopold, even though he was a rather uncomfortable with formal religion of any kind. But in the introduction to the San Kelny Almanac, where he talks about there are those who can do without wild things and those who cannot, and I'm one of those who cannot. And he says at the end of that introduction, I believe, he says, it's in nature, it's in the wildness. And he uses the word wildness. He doesn't say nature, he always says wildness, and I think that's important too. He says, it's where we get our meat from God. It's the only time he ever uses the word God that I've read in anything.
I just finished reading it, and yeah. He does use God a lot.
Yeah, does he? Hmm. Does he? Okay.
I'm not sure he believed in that he had
Could be. My take has always been that he's not inclined to believe in God. But if he's using it more than I'm aware, that would make me question that.
He may be using the language that ordinary people understand.
Yeah, he might be, but I don't see evidence of him doing that in other writings. So that would be an unusual move rhetorically for him to make. Especially given that it would be so easy for him to be misunderstood if he mm-hmm. decided to make that rhetorical move on that particular subject. So
I think he uses it as the creation. Really.
Hmm. Okay. Yeah, it could
but in
be.
In a practical way, what can we do to counter the forces that are causing this continued rapid population growth in many parts of the world? Even in the United States, that's a much too rapid growth. It's totally unsustainable.
Yeah, I think that the American population growth is largely due to immigration. I think our otherwise our
population of added people and the fact that many of those immigrants tend to have big families.
But they're not
so
immigrants
at least
that
for
do
one
too.
Generation, so that there's more
multiplying. Right. So
some
that
people don't get the picture at all.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to be in favor of very open borders. And to encourage immigration into the United States. But
you see a lot of these immigrants are escaping overpopulated countries.
Yes, I think there's some truth to that. Yeah.
To absorb that overflow of people who are desperate to get out of countries that are now overpopulated.
Yeah, you're right. You're asking me some very big questions. I don't know that I really know the answers. I guess my feeling is that we have to.
We can be compassionate, but that's not
we can
enough.
Yeah, but I think you raised a good question there when you say compassion. Is we have to have a reason to be compassionate. We have to have something that encourages us to make that move of compassion. Because by nature, human beings are only compassionate to a very limited extent. From an evolutionary perspective, we don't need to love all of mankind mm-hmm. or humankind. All we need to do is love our family, our kin, and our neighbors. And we were doing that.
We go beyond that.
Well, I think we do too, but I think it's because we can transcend some of that those instinctive limitations.
Don't you think that when people witness suffering, I care? Most people?
I think some people do. I think it's a range. You know the Milligan experiments that were done in the 1950s where people were willing to administer electric shocks to other people and watch the suffering, but as long as an authority figure told them to do it, they did it anyway.
That's scary.
In Germany, again, to not use the Germany in the 40s as the example for all the evil in the world, but people mm-hmm. saw a lot of suffering and let it happen.
Well,
so I think,
doing
our record, I think, is pretty mixed on that, I think. I think we need to fall in love with our land. We really need to do that. And I think we need to feel the common brother and sisterhood of all of us. We need to feel ourselves as a single species. with a single destiny.
Falling in love with technology and things instead
stop
of
keeping up with the Joneses.
It's understandable that we
major trend in worldwide.
Yeah, it's understandable that we love technology. Our lives have been improved so much by it for the last several hundred years, but I think our culture is beginning to recognize its limitations, and that's a step.
It's a snowball.
It's a step. Yeah.
Look what's happening in China, India, Brazil, many other countries that are rapidly building more and more cities, more and more automobiles.
And wanting more and more what we have.
Yeah. Well, I don't.
Anyway, that's a bigger issue.
Those are huge issues. Yeah, huge issues.
It's kind of. I feel that we're religion. I'm part of the religion. It's humanism. The ethics are very important, I think, in this dynamic.
Our speaker last month calls herself a religious humanist. Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself a secular humanist or a religious humanist?
Well, it all depends on how you use those terms. By the way that I use the term secular humanist, I would say I'm a secular humanist. But to me, you can be a secular humanist and be religious and spiritual.
I'm a humanist theist.
Yeah. Excuse me?
Theist.
Yeah, I'm a theist. I would say
You're
I'm
a humanist theist.
Yeah, I'm a secular humanist. Theist, religious, spiritual. I mean, I would. I'm trying to have it all. You know, what can I say? I'm an American, right? I want to ask you guys some questions. I don't know how much time we have, and that's here I've been talking about secular humanism. You guys are the Humanist Union of Madison. How do you define those terms? What does secularism mean to all of you? What does humanism mean to all of you?
Well, we don't use the term secular humanism. We just use humanist.
Humanist, okay. Sure.
So we're a comfortable problem.
My view of the term secular means that you're not tied to a particular church group.
Church group, sure. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Non-sectarian.
Mm-hmm.
A non-sectarian.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah, who else? I mean, how else do you define the term humanism?
I used to object to it because it left out the kingdom, the animal kingdom.
Yes, sure.
I still object to it somewhat. Okay. But I understand it better today.
Yeah, right, okay. Anybody else?
Well, I tend to say, if I'm just being very brief with someone, that as a humanist, I believe in love and compassion in human relationships, and I see no need for a supernatural explanation of anything in the known universe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Let me, if you don't mind, change the question a little bit. What brings you here? What brings you to this table to talk once a month together? Which I think is a wonderful thing that you
getting
do.
Getting a chance to hear you.
Oh, I doubt that.
And others.
And others. Okay, fair enough.
Usually it's a chance to get away from God talk.
Well, so you picked the wrong guy bringing me in here, right?
Right.
It's a nice food. The food. Yeah, well, that's
organic.
Organic food.
Yeah, we're foodies.
You're foodies. The salad was excellent, especially with the slivered almonds. That was a good touch.
That was good.
What
that's
else?
From my farm.
That was from your farm?
We have a huge crop of winter spinach and lettuce.
Oh, yeah.
It's
a good
the almonds, too?
Well, the almonds.
I was about to ask about the almonds.
With global warming, we might be able to get almond trees around.
Give it 50 years, we'll be growing almonds, maybe. So aside from the food and the chance to get away from God talk, which I suppose I sort of put the kibosh on that.
Meeting of minds,
uh-huh, uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a sense of community. This is a sort of community.
Yeah, we're a whole
tree.
Our host congregation is by nature inclusive of theists and non-theists both, and we tend to be mostly non-theists.
Non-theists, yeah, sure. Okay.
Besides, we all love to talk.
We love to talk. Right. I understand
and
that.
And Kirby Koch programs have gone very theist recently.
The programs have they?
We have more families with young children. I think that makes a difference, too.
Another important thing for me is that I'm really concerned about the influence of the religious right Christians.
Mm-hmm.
On our whole system, our socio-political system, especially in the United States.
Yeah,
and I I think it's very important that free thinkers like us, in the broadest sense, I love the term free thinkers.
That's my favorite. That is my favorite term. I often wish that the free congregation would be named. Free Thinker Hall. I mean, that's perfect. Yeah. And I think for me too, a worrying trend within the UU tradition, I think, is the increasing marginalization of agnostic or atheistic or non-theistic points of view. It's a trend that I'm seeing in the
UU. Last week said she's quite encouraged, though, with the new director.
Okay.
Who feels it's more of a humanist.
Is more of a humanist? Mm-hmm. Yeah, or a non-theist humanist, or however you want to define all these things. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think that's good news. Yeah.
I wasn't encouraged when I looked at the schedule for General Assembly, because there was only one event that mentioned humanism. Mm.
Yeah. How many events at the UUA mentioned non-theism?
Yeah. How about whole day of the humanist gathering?
Well, that's separate.
That's separate.
Right. Yeah. Put on by the humanists with two U's, however that's pronounced.
Q-U.
Yeah, yeah, however you pronounce it.
Who humanist? Well, it's about time to wind up, so let's thank our speaker.
No, thank you. Thank you all. Thank you all for your own remarks.